I considered dropping out of school, but my mother begged me to stay. God will protect you, child, she said. I pray for you night and day. You've got to start going to church too. Why did God fail to protect innocent students from the police? Nonetheless, I began to go to church on Sundays. Not so much to pray, but because I felt somewhat safe there. A change gradually came over me. I began to read the Bible more for renewal of strength and courage. I wandered from church to church, listened to sermons with new ears, and had pastors begin to preach liberation. Youngsters whose blood was shed in the battle against apartheid were called martyrs. Those who fled and became freedom fighters, the government called terrorists. In the churches, they were praised as heroes. Some churches in Soweto and Pretoria sang freedom songs as part of their liturgy, in open defiance of the authorities. Burials for slain youth often turned into political rallies. Coffins were borne to the graveyard, draped in ANC colors of gold, green, and black by young men and women wearing ANC t-shirts, amid chants of "Amandla Awethu, Amandla Awethu," and black power salutes. The police countered by dispersing mourners with tear gas, police dogs, rubber bullets, and truncheons. Chapter 46. I finally met Andrew Zitzman, and he proved a dear friend. Blonde-haired, well-built, and as graceful as a cat on the court, Andre was one of South Africa's rising tennis stars. At 24, he had already won dozens of prestigious tournaments and had participated in Wimbledon and the US Open. With his vast experience, he offered to teach me the finer points of the game. We began meeting clandestinely on Saturday mornings at Ellis Park or some private court in the suburbs, where he gave lessons. We both were aware of the serious risks involved in playing together in a white neighborhood, but we never dwelled on them. I came to know Andre rather well. In fact, like Wilfred and his patrons at the ranch, abnormally well considering the type of society we were living in. Gradually, we both began feeling comfortable discussing issues that were taboo in meetings between black and white. Politics, equality, freedom. In this way, Andre, who took no offense to my calling him by his first name, came to tell me about his experiences as a student in America. "It was very frightening at first," he said, "to see black people and white people living together side by side in New York and Washington, cities as big as Johannesburg and Cape Town. In America, there are no laws which keep blacks and whites apart. Blacks vote and get elected to the American Parliament, where together with whites, they make laws for the benefit of everyone in the country. And these laws say that all people are created equal by God, and therefore should be judged not by their color, but only on merit." "You mean to tell me," I said incredulously, "that there's not a single apartheid law in America, no Influx Control or Group Areas Act or Immorality Act? Though I knew from hearsay and from reading newspapers and books that American society was freer than South African society, somehow, my experiences as a black man who had lived all his life under unremitting oppression and racism told me that no country in the world that had blacks and whites living together and was run by the latter was without racial segregation of some form. Americans have none of those laws," Andre said. "They used to have something similar to apartheid years ago, in what they call the southern states, but Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the others changed most of that." He was driving me to the black bus stop following a practice session. Saturday morning traffic was heavy. he pulled into a parking lot of a hypermarket to continue his American saga. "Try imagining," Andre said as he inconspicuously parked the car, and I immediately leaped to the back seat so as not to arouse suspicion by being seated in front with him. Blacks rarely sat with whites in the front seats of cars. Andre flaunted this unwritten law whenever I was with him, but on this occasion, our presence in a parking lot teeming with white faces made me insist on sitting in the back. "Try imagining," he repeated, rolling up the windows of his Volvo. "The whole of Johannesburg, Soweto, Alexandra, and all the other black locations included, as one big city, instead of the racial checkerboard it now is under the Group Areas Act. Imagine that in this new Johannesburg, blacks, whites, coloreds, and Indians were allowed to live any place they wished, as long as they could afford it. That's how many cities are like in America." I shook my head. I could not believe, despite his sincerity, what he was telling me. I tried imagining how white South Africans would react to blacks suddenly appearing in their pure, affluent, silent as a tomb suburbs. Not as nannies, garden boys, garden girls, washerwomen and maids, but as neighbors. Many whites in South Africa would rather go to war or die than have a black for a neighbor. "How did you," I asked Andre, "function in such an environment?" He laughed. I found it unbelievably confusing at first. Bewildering is the right word. For a long time, I felt strangely out of place, as if I were a visitor to another planet, so to speak. I had lived in South Africa all my life, been raised by black nannies, and had every black person call me boss and master and obey my every desire and whim. I had parents who sent me to the best whites-only schools, where part of my education was how to lord over blacks. They made me take lessons in tennis, music, swimming, cricket, rugby, dance, and all other kinds of things, while your parents were debating whether to buy you your first primer and let the family starve. I had a government whose laws provided me with every one of life's comforts, protected my alleged superiority, power, and privilege, and made me feel like a king who would live forever in a golden paradise. I never felt guilty about it all. I was told that God wanted us to live that way. That was why he made us white. I was told that you blacks deserved to be our servants because that's God's way of punishing you for the sins committed by your ancestor, Ham. All this was my world, my reality. Then suddenly, there I was, at 18, thrust into a world where all those illusions were shattered. In America, blacks attended the same schools with me, sat in the same classes, and had the same teachers, some of whom were blacks. I slept with blacks in the same dormitory, ate meals with them in the same cafeterias. I was shocked and horrified. No one was calling me boss and master any longer. There was more. I had to use the same libraries as blacks, the same toilets and showers, ride in the same buses, trains and taxis. Everywhere blacks, it seemed, were telling me what to do. The varsity teams had dozens of black players, and boy, what superb athletes. No white man could beat them in basketball, boxing, and football. He tried to explain American football, which was different from South African football, soccer. He paused. We sipped orange juice from a flask. He went on. But what shocked me the most was that blacks and whites could mix freely at social gatherings and parties. They could even date without the scepter of being convicted under the Immorality Act hanging over them. Some even intermarried and had children. And the government didn't move in and reclassify everyone as white, black, and colored. My head spun as I listened. My mouth was so wide open all through Andre's speech that the police could have flown right in, and I wouldn't have noticed or cared. My mind was feverishly trying to compare American society, the way Andre depicted it, with that of South Africa. There was no comparison whatsoever. The two societies appeared light years apart. America seemed a society moving rapidly toward a greater accommodation of its diverse population. South Africa, on the other hand, was moving with equal speed, if not more, toward a total separation of all races. Would I ever see this promised land? Chapter 47. Andre grew into a close friend. The personality changes he underwent while in America enabled him to accept me as an equal, to respect my opinions and idiosyncrasies as a black man, no matter how abstruse he found them, or how vehemently he disagreed with them at times. Knowing him convinced me that the white man of South Africa could change his ways of oppression if he wanted to. In refusing to do so, he was simply being greedy, intransigent, and ruled by unfounded fears and mistaken beliefs. If 4 years of attending college in America had awakened Andre to the brutal reality of how wrong his race was in subjugating blacks, if those 4 years had so wrecked his conscience that he now realized that there was more underneath the black skin than he was previously prepared to admit, let alone accept, if 4 years of living in America had taught him that apartheid was wrong, 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 then I had hoped that someday the rest of his race could similarly awaken, if they wanted to. My family was again experiencing hard times. My mother had left her job to give birth to another child, her seventh, a pretty, dimpled girl named Lena. We were now 2 boys and 5 girls. My father had again been laid off. Starvation stared us in the face. There was no money for police bribes, no diapers or baby food for the infant. I hunted for peace jobs in the suburbs, to no avail. At many places, I was considered the wrong type of garden boy, messenger, car washer, or dishwasher, simply because I had committed the unpardonable sin of being educated beyond the limits acceptable to whites who ran the various establishments from which I sought employment. "There's no place here for natives like you," was the usual reply I received from white people. "You've got too much education. If we hired you, you might cause trouble among our obedient workers. We don't want a mutiny. This is a peaceful country." In other places, just when I thought I might be hired, I was told to first obtain a permit allowing me to work in a white neighborhood. I couldn't get a permit because the damn thing had to be stamped on a pass. And I couldn't qualify for a pass because my parents had no legal permit to live in Alexandria. I discussed the situation with Andre. He promised to seek ways of helping me and the family. "Why don't you come and work for me at the sports shop?" he said one Saturday afternoon as he was driving me to the black bus stop following a tennis lesson. "But I don't have a permit," I said. "I don't care," he said. I thought for a moment. "It's too risky, Andre," I said. "I don't want to jeopardize the tennis deal we have. Thanks anyway." One Saturday afternoon, following one of our clandestine tennis lessons, he gave me 50 rands and a bag full of tennis clothes, sweaters, shorts, socks, shirts, dresses, and warm-ups. He also gave me 3 Dornay tennis rackets. Thanks, Sundry, I said, greatly humbled by the gesture. I'll pay you back the money as soon as I find a job.
Don't worry about it, he said. I'm glad to be of some help.
He added jokingly, we whites have everything, and you guys have nothing, you know? So we have to make attempts to equalize things sometimes. Otherwise, how could we deal with our consciences? How true. The money bought the family groceries, the infant, diapers, medicine, and formula food until my mother could come out of seclusion and resume work as a washing girl. I shared the tennis clothes with my brother and sisters. My tennis game improved tremendously from playing with Andre. I still visited the ranch and played with Helmut during the week, but I learned more from the surreptitious Saturday morning meetings with Andre. I now won many of my matches for the school team with ease, and black players of every level and age in Alexandra became regular victims of my strong net game. I won the Alexandra Open Tennis Championships for the 2nd time. Despite missing more than half a year of school, I passed Form 4 in the top 1% of the class. In January of 1977, 3 months after my 17th birthday, I entered my final year of matriculation. Simba Quicks, for which I had worked during the Christmas holidays, renewed my scholarship. I was confident of passing the final exams in December, so I began mapping out my future plans. Mr. Wilde at Simba Quicks indicated that whether or not I passed matric, his company was eager to train me as one of its new generation of black salesmen, and that if I did well as a salesman, I could quickly move up within the company. Simba Quicks was doing a lot to open up managerial and supervisory positions to blacks. There were already 1 or 2 black district managers in the company. And we now pay our black and white managers the same, Mr. Wilde boasted. We are trying to remove apartheid from our company. I considered the Simba Quicks offer and was tempted to accept it. My mother, grandmother, uncles, and aunts, for various reasons, implored me to do so. With your brain, Uncle Pete said, you'll be paid like a king. And then you can build the family a house like those in Dube, complete with a 2-door garage, swimming pool, tennis court, electricity, and garden. The minority of blacks who lived in Dube, a posh section of the otherwise squalid Soweto, also known as Beverly Hills, were a well-to-do elite. They had the same aspirations as whites. As the upper crust, or black middle class, they wielded considerable power in local and national black politics, and the government frequently consulted with them on black issues and appointed them as mayors and town councillors. They were largely conservative, less inclined to embrace revolution as a method of ending apartheid. What they sought was not so much a radical restructuring of South African society as the removal of those features of apartheid that held back black initiative and enterprise. A prominent leader of this elite black middle class was even quoted in a Johannesburg Daily as saying that he didn't believe many blacks wanted one person, one vote in South Africa. Houses like those in Dube were always shown off to foreign tourists during their trips.
You see how well our natives live, a government official would proudly tell a bus full of incredulous American, Japanese, and European tourists. Even many of us whites can't afford to live like that. Then the tourists would wonder what was wrong with apartheid.
Uncle Pete and the rest of my kin yearned to live like those blacks in Dube and saw me as the only person in the family who could make their yearnings come true.
Don't you want to end all my misery, child? Implored Granny. I've been working all these years and I am tired.
You alone can make me happy in the twilight of my life. Take the Simba job when you finish school, child. Promise me you will. Taking the job will give meaning to all those years you've spent struggling through school," Aunt Bushy pointed out.
"You know that I've now given my life over to God," said Uncle Cheeks, who had just returned from the penitentiary. "I read the scriptures every day, and God speaks to me at every waking and sleeping hour. You, he tells me, have been chosen to lead the family out of the land of poverty and destitution. Do not go against God's wish, nephew. Take the job when you finish school, and manna will begin pouring from heaven so we all can eat."
My father insisted that I repay him for bringing me into this world by taking up the job and providing for him. Any of these reasons would have compelled me to take up the Simba Quicks job after matriculation. But somehow in my heart I knew that I would never be happy until I had breathed and tasted that freedom a society like America could give me. Yes, I could work for Simba Quicks, easily rise to the level of manager and get paid oodles of money, with which I could perhaps transform my family and relatives into solid members of the black middle class. Yes, that way I would have accomplished a lot by becoming somebody in the black community and being able to bask in the glory of having made it despite apartheid. But would it mean anything for as long as the thought haunted me that despite all my successes, I still was not free? That I still was regarded as an alien in the land of my birth, a kafir, that I still had to think and feel and act the way apartheid wanted me to, that I still had to carry a pass and watch black men and women brutally denied the right to live in dignity and freedom. Something inside me told me I would never be happy. I had to leave South Africa somehow. Somehow I had to get to America, the promised land, where I hoped to find the freedom to use whatever talents I had. But how does one get from Alexandra to America? Chapter 48. On September 12, 1977, newspaper headlines blazed. Stephen Biko dies in police custody. The world was shocked. Anger swept the ghettos. The vocal and charismatic leader of the Black Consciousness Movement, a body formed in the late 1960s and made up of black, colored, and Indian students, whose goal was to fight for the ending of apartheid without the assistance of what it called paternalistic white liberalism, had been silenced forever by the government. When he was detained on August 16th under Section 6 of the Terrorism Act, he was a robust 33-year-old black man, full of a passion for living, for giving selflessly of himself in the struggle against apartheid. His mysterious death 16 days later raised charges by blacks that he had been cold-bloodedly murdered by the South African police. It was rumored that his head was so bashed during interrogation in a police station in Durban that his brain hemorrhaged. The police then decided that he be taken to an interrogation center in Johannesburg, a distance of about 200 miles. A white doctor pronounced him fit for the journey. His naked body was then loaded into the back of a van in the dead of night. He died en route. The press demanded a full inquiry. Opposition leaders in parliament demanded the prosecution of those connected with his death. The United States and other Western nations demanded the abolishing of South Africa's draconian security laws, which allowed for detention without trial. Members of the Black Consciousness Movement vowed to continue the struggle. The government reacted with savage crackdowns.
On October 19th, I picked up the paper only to find that the Black Consciousness Movement, the Black Parents Association, the Black People's Convention, the Black Communities Programs, the South African Students Organizations, SASO, the Christian Institute, and various other organizations committed to seeking the ending of apartheid through nonviolent means had been banned as communist fronts hiding under sweet-sounding names and aims. The largest black newspaper, The World, with a circulation of over 200,000, was shut down, its journalists and editor, Percy Gobosa, detained. Dozens of black leaders were also detained, including several prominent whites opposed to apartheid. Beyers Naudé of the Christian Institute, and Donald Woods, editor of the East London Dispatch, and a friend of Biko's. In Alexandra, army vehicles became a daily sight. The authorities were given additional power over black people, as if they didn't already have absolute power over our lives from birth to death. Gatherings attended by more than three persons, for whatever purpose, even to bury a slain loved one, were banned. Plots to massacre whites were uncovered, and those involved imprisoned without trial and tortured. Troops were deployed to guard entrances to the white suburbs. The number of black informants in the ghettos was beefed up. Daily I heard stories of friends and kindred betraying one another. Mass paranoia so gripped the ghettos, reminding me of the reign of terror during the French Revolution, that I could not even trust my own mother. I attended meetings where black youths sought ways to get hold of submachine guns and grenades with which to storm white kindergartens and schools and shopping malls in the name of liberation. I was confused. I was desperate. I was angry. Yet I lacked the courage to even face the thought of blowing up the kindergarten where Wilfred's son attended. But I had to do something to fight back. I had to find ways of avenging the deaths of hundreds of innocent black children. I had to find ways of dealing with the anger and hate consuming me day by day. As always, I sought refuge in books and tennis. The two somehow restored my sanity. I sensed that, in a way, by reading and playing tennis while my brothers and sisters were dying in the streets, I was shirking my responsibilities in the struggle. I was on the side of apartheid by thinking too much of my own safety and interests. To relieve my tormented conscience, I convinced myself that it was futile, it was suicidal to fight bullets and truncheons with stones, armored vehicles and tear gas with shouts of Amandla aware to, and fists clenched in black power salutes. I led myself to believe that there were other ways of fighting the awesome apartheid machinery besides fleeing the country and joining the ANC as a freedom fighter. As I grappled with my conscience, in me became born a fanatical determination that if I ever left South Africa alive, I would devote every minute of my time, every ounce of my strength, to fighting for the liberation of my countrymen. What my weapons would be, I didn't know. Chapter 49. My desperate desire to leave South Africa led me to start taking risks, to allow people to use me to my advantage. One Saturday morning, as we were about to leave Ellis Park following a practice session, Helmut said, "Why don't you enter next month's SAB, South African Breweries Open?" The tournament was the same one Arthur Ashe nearly won in 1973. Held during the last week of November and first week of December, it consistently attracted top-class players from around the world, thanks to the efforts of Owen Williams, its impresario, renowned in the tennis world as an innovative and astute director. He was supposed to have so successfully directed the world-famous US Open that the Americans entreated him to become permanent director. He declined the offer. The SAB was regarded as one of the major tournaments in the world, and that year's field, I read in newspapers, promised to be the largest and most illustrious ever, with many of the top American men and women players entered. Since Arthur Ashe and Yvonne Goolagong, now Corley, participated in the tournament. It had been opened to black South African players as well. But the best of us weren't good enough to even win a match in the qualifying round. A sort of mini-tournament where scores of amateurs and professionals, a majority of them white South Africans, who didn't have enough points to qualify, played each other for a handful of slots in the main draw. I didn't want to become another sacrificial lamb. Moreover, 1977 was a year when SALTU was under pressure from the International Tennis Federation, ITF, to open its doors to blacks or face expulsion. Already several countries had made it a policy to refuse to play against South African teams in the Davis Cup and the Federation Cup. Others had even gone to the extent of barring white South African players from tournaments held on their soil. South Africa was also banned from Olympic competition, international track and field, swimming, World Cup soccer, cricket, rugby, and a dozen or so other sports. Black athletes across the country gloated over such isolation. Maybe, we thought, whites will finally remove apartheid from sports. As the isolation increased, and white players began leaving the country and taking up citizenship in America and Britain, the authorities announced a few cosmetic changes in sports apartheid. Integrated bleachers, mixed professional tournaments, and selection of token black players to national teams. Blacks called such meaningless tinkering a sham. So, aware that white tennis officials were under pressure, black tennis officials refused to release players to take part in this SAB Open, insisting that the former pledged to take immediate steps to integrate tennis at all levels. "But that can't be done," cried white tennis officials. "Not immediately, anyway. That's against the law." "Then change the law," black tennis officials insisted.
"We are not politicians," countered white tennis officials. "Sports and politics don't mix.
So don't count on our players showing up to save your hide," retorted black tennis officials. With the beginning of the tournament fast approaching, and word already out that the ITF would be sending a delegation to investigate how integrated South African tennis was, white officials searched frantically for black token players. One of the officials, Peter Murphy, director of the Ellis Park Tennis Facility, had often seen Helmut and me play, and he already knew of my involvement with the Barrett's Tennis Ranch. Apparently my audacity to break apartheid laws in sports had made me notorious in white tennis circles. Unknown to me, Murphy had talked Helmut into coaxing me to enter the SAB Open.
"Enter the SAB Open?" I laughed.
"You must be joking. Who am I to play against the likes of Stan Smith and Jimmy Connors?"
"There's a way," he said with a mysterious grin, "for you to take part in the qualifying rounds. And if you win, you could find yourself facing Stan Smith in the first round."
Continuing to laugh, I said, "Thanks a lot for the joke."
"I'm serious," Helmut said. "Just say yes, I want to play right this minute and we'll talk to Peter Murphy about it."
"Who's Peter Murphy?" he told me. Remembering the refusal of the Black Tennis Association to send players to the Open, I said, "I don't want to be used by white people."
"But," countered Helmut, "you're always complaining that you lack competition. And what happened to your dream of contacting American universities about tennis scholarships? You would meet a lot of Americans in this tournament if you played, and they might be able to help you. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Yes, whites may be using you, but it's all to your advantage."
I was desperate to make contact with American tennis players. The lure of playing in a tournament with some of the best names in tennis was irresistible. I agreed to play. The tournament was 2 weeks away. I immediately embarked on a crash program to sharpen my tennis skills and get in shape. physically and mentally. I jogged twice a day, 10 miles each time. I skipped rope for an hour each day. I ate food rich in carbohydrates and protein. I served at least 1,000 balls each day, topspin, slice, flat. I lifted weights, did push-ups, sit-ups, double knee jumps, and yoga. I worked out with a ball machine, played scores of tough sets against Wilfred and Scaramouche. I pored over dozens of tennis books dealing with strategy and tactics. Each day I would go to bed exhausted. Throughout the night I would toss and turn, drenched in a cold sweat, unable to sleep. But at the crack of dawn the next day, I would be up to catch the first bus to the ranch. "Are you trying to kill yourself?" my mother said one morning. Throughout the night, I had hallucinated and vomited. "No, Mama," I said. "I'm getting ready for a tennis tournament." Andre agreed to work out with me in the morning at Ellis Park, twice a week. He too was playing in the tournament. Word about my decision to play in the tournament reached Sanaltu and I was ordered to withdraw immediately or be banned for life from black tennis. "Johannes, don't be a fool. Don't push your luck too far. Can't you see that the bloody white bastards are using you? Withdraw from the tournament or face dire consequences." Read an anonymous letter. I was in a quandary. I sought advice. Scaramouche told me to go ahead and play. "But Umskari," I said, "each time we play, we are slaughtered. It's been 4 years since Arthur Ashurst came to this country. And how much progress have we made? Where is the next Arthur Ashe? Tennis is still as segregated as ever." "That may be true," said Scaramouche, sipping Coca-Cola from a mug. "But I believe the attitude of white tennis players and officials is changing. It's only a matter of time before we have true integration in sports." "What about the argument that there can be no normal sports in an abnormal society?" I asked. "That's too simple a way of putting it," Scaramouche said. "If you study the history of blacks in America, you'll find that sports were often at the forefront of change." Scaramouche's argument was persuasive, but my mind was still undecided. I sought my mother's advice. "Don't push your luck too far, child," my mother said. "This time the death threats may be for real. Why don't you just forget about this tennis, huh? You've got a lot going for you, child. Can't you see? Soon you'll be finished with school. And the Simba Chips Company will hire you and pay you very well. And you'll be able to build yourself a nice big house, marry a respectable girl, and live comfortably. Is that not enough, child?" "Mama," I said, "I don't think I'll be happy leading that kind of life. Tennis is my life. I want it to take me to America, where I can breathe freedom and do something truly meaningful with my life. Something which will make you and millions of black people proud. Is that not worth more than simply being another slave for white people?" "Still dreaming of America, I see," my mother said with a sigh of resignation. "But do you for a moment think that such a preposterous dream can ever come true?" "It will, Mama. What black man has ever done what you are hallucinating you'll do?" "No one," I said with a smile. "I'll be the first." "My child, I give up on you," my mother sighed. "But I will pray for you. I hope you know what you're getting into." The matchups for the qualifying round were announced. My first match was against Abe Siegel, a former Wimbledon doubles champion with Gordon Forbes. Siegel had been one of South Africa's premier singles and doubles players during the 50s. Though past his peak, he still played a mean game of singles. So what was I? An inexperienced, starstruck, half-formed black tennis player, going to be to him but fodder. If I needed an excuse for withdrawing, I told myself, this was it. No way should you make a fool of yourself by getting on the same court with the former Wimbledon champion. Just pick up the phone and tell Owen Williams to scratch your name. I was alone in the bar. Wilfred was out on the court giving a lesson. I decided to tell him of my decision not to play in the tournament as soon as he finished. Owen Williams and Peter Murphy had told me that I could withdraw from the tournament at any time I felt my life was in danger. Wilfred came into the bar. I waited until the white men who had had the lesson left. Wilfred, I said, as we did the monthly bookkeeping, I'm thinking of withdrawing from next week's SAB Open. He looked surprised. Why? There are too many risks. You mean the threats to ban you? Yes, that and the death threats. Well, he said, if that's how you feel, just pick up the phone and call Owen Williams. It's as simple as that. What's your opinion on the whole thing anyway? I think you should go ahead and play, Wilfred said. It's the best thing you can do for your game. Just being in the tournament will give you a tremendous psychological boost. Also, you may get noticed and get the sponsorship to help you move up in tennis. Play more tournaments overseas. Who knows, you may even get a scholarship to America. But that's only my opinion. You may feel differently. It's your life. I picked up the phone book and slowly dialed Ellis Park and asked to speak to Owen Williams. He was sympathetic to my dilemma, acknowledged the risks I would be taking if I played, but in his opinion thought I should go ahead and play because the advantages outweighed the risks. But I may be killed, I said. I don't think so, Owen Williams said. The death threats are only a bluff. And the threat to ban me for life? Is that a bluff too? To be honest with you, Owen Williams said, that may be the best thing that can happen to your tennis. If you're banned, I'll make sure you get into a white club. And you know the difference between black and white tennis, don't you? There was a pause. I weighed the risks. I'm being used, am I not? I said. Yes, in a way, Owen Williams said bluntly. But before you make up your mind, let me tell you this. The future of black tennis lies in the hands of whites, any way you choose to see it. The attitudes of whites have to change, and are changing, and steps are being taken to bring about non-racial tennis. But you blacks have to do your part too. I'll be the first to admit that much more still needs to be done before tennis is truly non-racial. But we have to start somewhere. But instead of helping, what is the Black Tennis Association doing? Using tennis as a political tool. It won't work. You and I know that the government would rather have South Africa isolated from the rest of all the world in sports than see integrated sports overnight, if at all. Things have to be done slowly. Real change is gradual and often painful. Putting pressure on the white man, trying to blackmail him, won't work. You know these Afrikaners. Pressure only makes them more stubborn, more fearful of change. It sends them scurrying behind a lager. And this pressure by the Black Tennis Association and the rest of the world is counterproductive. I see their point, but I don't agree with it. All it can do is to make whites less committed to change. Make them go it alone. And South Africa has a marvelous record of going it alone. This is not the time for your tennis leaders to turn their back on us. You've got to help us to change. Owen Williams' argument made sense, but I knew the decision to play or not to play rested on me. I knew that despite his genuine commitment to integrated tennis, he wanted me to play so as to deflect criticism why there weren't any blacks in the tournament. I could hear him say to the ITF. He is the only one. Others like him who had wanted to play pulled out at the last minute because of pressure from their leaders. These leaders don't have the best interest of their tennis players at heart. They've told us that if we want them to play in our tournaments, then we have to give them the vote first. Fundamental change takes time, but the black man wants everything overnight. I told Owen Williams that I needed a day to think the matter over and would get back to him. But it was already a foregone conclusion what my final decision would be. Chapter 50. The Saturday morning of the most important tennis match of my life was bright and sunny. Wilfred couldn't come with me to Ellis Park because Saturday morning was one of the busiest times at the ranch. But the evening before, he gave me a pair of new tennis shoes and 10 rands taxi fare. And he and members of the ranch wished me well. "Remember, don't be nervous," he advised. "Don't rush your strokes. Be prepared to stay out on the court the whole day if that's what it takes to win. Seagull is an experienced bugger. He knows you're much younger than he, so he'll want to end the match quickly. Slow him down. Don't play his game. Move him around. Wear him out. Let him make the mistakes. And watch out. He's a left-hander too." My family was unable to come see me play. I packed my 3 rackets and 2 extra shirts and a pair of shorts in a duffel bag. My mother said a prayer before I left and entreated my ancestors to guide and protect me. My sisters wished me well, and George promised to come to Ellis Park after he had caddied at a golf course in a white suburb nearby. On my way to the bus rank, I encountered hostile stares. The papers had carried stories of my decision to enter the tournament, and black people thought me a traitor. Some spat at me. I avoided taking the bus. The taxi dropped me right at the gate of Ellis Park Tennis Stadium. It was 9 o'clock. My match was not until 11. The stadium was already thronging with people. I noticed that an unusual number of blacks were present, mostly tennis players from Soweto and Pretoria. About 3 or 4 officials from the Black Tennis Association were also present. No doubt they had come to see me humiliated. Nobody spoke to me. They only gave me cold stares and muttered, "Traitor," and "Uncle Tom," under their breath. It hurt. "They have it all wrong," I told myself. "I'm not a traitor or an Uncle Tom. If only they knew the true reason why I'm playing." Abe Siegel was well known for his clowning on the tennis court, much in the fashion of the Romanian Ili Nastasi. I met him in the locker room just before the match, and he cracked a joke. I laughed, but felt nervous at the same time. When we arrived at one of the main outside courts where we were to play, we found it packed with reporters and white spectators. There was even a television crew. Ironically, none of this unnerved me as much as the group of black spectators in one corner of the grandstand. There were big names like Stan Smith, Roscoe Tanner, John Newcomb, Bob Hewitt, Frew McMillan, and Bob Lutz entered in the tournament. Yet, it seemed every spectator wanted to see me play. For a while, anyway. We warmed up. I started play slowly, tentatively. Due to a nervous stomach, I had missed breakfast and I felt lightheaded. I had played against left-handers before, but Abe Siegel's style of play confused me. He kept spinning the ball, hitting it soft, angling it sharply. He played what is commonly called junk tennis. I tried to whack the ball down his throat. I became impatient. I hurried my strokes and I made one unforced error after another. He won the first set, 6-2. The crowd, which had been cheering me on, began drifting away. At changeovers, I would glance at the black spectators. Many gloated. An elderly white man in a tennis outfit came up to me as I was taking a sip of water.
"Run him down," he said, leaning over the fence. "He's got no knees anymore."
"That's what I'm trying to do," I said. "Instead, he's the one that's making me run." My determination, enthusiasm, and youth were no match for Siegel's vast experience and skill. I lost the second set, 6-3. When we shook hands over the net, he patted me on the shoulder and said, "That was a good match. Better luck next time. Don't give up." I went back to the locker room, drained and depressed. "You've let your people down," I told myself. Naked white South African tennis players milled around the locker room, getting ready for matches or about to shower. I was the only black. I felt out of place. "That was a good match," they offered their sympathies. I didn't shower or change. I went back outside and roamed the tennis courts. Everywhere I went, white people smiled at me and said, "That was a good match." The black people I met laughed at me, as if saying, "Didn't we warn you, fool?" I began to feel guilty. I was convinced that I'd played atrociously, that I had been a disgrace to my race. What American university would bother to give a scholarship to such a loser? At dusk, I headed home in a crowded black bus. Though I was out of the tournament, I returned regularly to Ellis Park, dressed in my tennis outfit and carrying my rackets. I was on the prowl for anyone to hit with. I came to practice against professionals like Frew McMillan, Peter Fleming, and Fred McNair. They offered me valuable pointers and urged me to gain more tournament experience. Whenever I practiced with American players, I was quick to ask them about tennis scholarships. Many gave me addresses of their former schools to write to, adding that I should feel free to mention that I knew them. One weekday afternoon, on my way home from Ellis Park, I bought the paper, only to read, "Black tennis player banned for life." So the die was cast. I was now a tennis player cut off from his roots. I approached Owen Williams, and he told me that my predicament would have to wait until the end of the tournament. Was this his way of reneging on his promise to help me join a white club? I was aware of the fact that our history was littered with the white men's broken promises. One Tuesday morning, midway through the tournament, I didn't feel like going to Ellis Park. I was down to my last rand. Also, I could no longer bear the pain of meeting with contemptuous stares and oaths from black tennis officials and spectators. But there was nothing to do at home, and I had called the ranch and found that Wilfred had gone to Ellis Park. So I packed my tennis bag and headed for the same. I wandered about the courts. I was on the lookout for Wilfred and for more American players to hit with. On one of the outside courts, I found two of them practicing, Stan Smith and Bob Lutz, the number one doubles team in the world. I sat on a bench overlooking the court, mesmerized by their impeccable styles. Stan Smith, tall, lanky, and powerfully built, with blonde hair and blue eyes, was one of the world's greatest serve and volley players. He moved about the court with the ease and grace of a gazelle, and his well-chiseled face, which from time to time broke into a smile, seemed that of a man at peace with himself and the world. Bob Lutz was stocky and powerfully built. He was a fine all-around player with excellent ground strokes. Both Smith and Lutz were excellent singles players in their own right. Smith was in the quarterfinals of the tournament and had once been the top player in the world. But it was as a doubles team that he and Lutz were famous the world over. Favored to win the tournament, they held several doubles records, and watching them play was as exciting as watching a match of singles. So there I was in the shadow of those two giants of tennis. I found it hard to believe they were made of flesh and blood as I watched them display complete mastery over the racket and the tennis ball. I wondered if even after a lifetime of playing tennis, I could ever be half as good as they. I felt sad that I was growing up in South Africa, where I would probably never get the chance to realize my fullest potential in the game. From time to time, Stan Smith looked at me and smiled. I smiled back. Apparently they had been playing for some time, for Bob Lutz said, "I've had enough, Stan. I think I'll call it a day." The two then headed for their tennis bags on the side of the court, near where I stood, awed. I had my three tennis rackets with me in a bag slung over my shoulder. I inched nearer to where the two stood, dying for autographs, shy of asking. Stan Smith, as he dried his face, looked me up and down, saw that I was in tennis garb and had my racket with me, and said, "Would you like to hit some?" I couldn't believe my ears. A chance to hit against a Wimbledon champion? My hero? I walked onto the court as if in a dream. Bob Lutz left as Stan and I began playing. I was so nervous, I feared I would bumble and make a fool of myself. Anyway, could I return any of those powerful strokes I had seen Stan hit with such ease just moments ago? I did. I was ecstatic. There was the Stan Smith chasing after balls I had hit and missing some of them. I felt such joy I could have died right at that moment and it wouldn't have mattered. Suddenly, all the pain I had endured since entering the tournament seemed not in vain. "Step into the ball. Follow through. That's much better. Now stay on your toes and move those feet. Good. Good. Relax your arm now. Don't throttle the racket. Watch the ball all the way. Good. Good." The instructions and praise came over the net. Each time I did as Stan suggested, my strokes seemed to improve a thousandfold. "Try some serves," he said in his mellifluous American accent. He told me what worked and what didn't with my serve. Some of the pointers he gave me I already knew, but the fact that it was he saying them turned them into utterings from an oracle. For about half an hour, I played the best tennis of my life, played like a man possessed. A crowd of black and white spectators had gathered about the court, and people were pointing at me and nodding their heads. Just as we stopped playing, I saw a slim, blonde-haired, white woman in a white Adidas warm-up, standing near the fence, pocketbook in hand. She was very pretty. I instantly recognized her from photos I had seen in a recent tennis magazine. She was Marjorie Gengler, Stan Smith's wife. Stan, as soon as he finished signing autographs, introduced me to her. She said, "You're quite a good player." A pair of white youngsters in school uniforms leaned over the fence and requested my autograph. I signed the back of their notebooks and their faces beamed. I was soaked with sweat, and Stan, noticing that I had no sweater, gave me one of his. I would frame this sweater and put it on the wall, I thought with joy. Stan and Marjorie suggested we have a snack in the players' lounge, an exclusive dining area that was off limits to blacks, not by design, but because mostly South Africa's wealthy went there to mingle with the superstars. There I was, walking side by side with one of the best and most respected tennis players in the world and his wife, chatting with them as if they were bosom friends of mine. If everyone could see me now! On the way to the players' lounge, Stan and Marjorie asked me about my family, school, and where I lived. They seemed so eager to know me. I poured my heart out to them. I drew them vivid pictures of Alexandra, of black life, of the hardships I faced not only as a tennis player and a student, but also as a young man growing up in a ghetto. Much of what I said shocked them. They cared. I suddenly remembered that I had read somewhere that Stan Smith was a graduate of the University of Southern California, where he had studied on a tennis scholarship, and that Marjorie had played number one for the Princeton University women's tennis team. Why not tell them about my American dream? As we entered the players' lounge, all eyes were on us. Important people went out of their way to greet Stan and Marjorie, and each time they did, I was introduced by the Smiths as a friend. We sat at one of the middle tables and had a sandwich and orange juice snack. Stan and Margie neither drank nor smoked. I didn't either. Stan queried me more about my tennis and what my future plans were. All the time we were talking, Stan and Marjorie treated me as an equal, a friend, a human being. Never for a moment did they show signs of condescension. The attitude toward me made me feel even more at ease, self-confident. It made me bolder in asking personal questions and at the same time reveal my innermost feelings. I wondered if white South African celebrities, including those who regarded themselves as liberal, would have deigned to treat me as an equal in a room full of whites. Yet, here were two white persons whom I had known hardly a day, treating me as if we had known each other for years, as if we were brothers and sisters. Marjorie proved the more inquisitive of the two. Baffled by the complexities of apartheid, she asked me to explain why blacks didn't fight to change the system that so dehumanized them. I told her about the sophistication of the apartheid machinery, the battery of draconian laws used to buttress it, the abject poverty in which a majority of blacks were sunk, leaving them with little energy and will to agitate for their rights. I told her about the indoctrination that took place in black schools under the guise of Bantu education, the self-hatred that resulted from being constantly told you are less than human and being treated that way. I told her of the anger and hatred pent up inside millions of blacks, destroying their minds. I would have gone on to tell Marjorie and Stan about the suffering of wives without husbands and children without fathers in impoverished tribal reserves, about the high infant mortality rate among blacks in a country that exported food and which in 1967 gave the world its first heart transplant. I would have told them about the rugged black boys and girls of 7, 8, and 9 years who constantly left their homes because of hunger and a disintegrating family life and were making it on their own. By begging along the thoroughfares of Johannesburg, by sleeping in scrapped cars, gutters, and in abandoned buildings, by bathing in the diseased Jeksge River, and by eating out of trash cans, sucking festering sores, and stealing rotting produce from the Indian traders on First Avenue. I would have told them about how these orphans of the streets, some of them my friends, their physical, intellectual, and emotional growth dwarfed and stunted, had grown up to become prostitutes, unwed mothers, and tsotsis, littering the ghetto streets with illegitimate children and corpses. I would have told them all this, but I didn't. I feared they would not believe me. I feared upsetting them. When we parted, my soul was uplifted, my hope for the future renewed. At the same time, I felt sad. I had fallen in love with the Smiths and did not want to leave them. Never in my life had I met such honest, caring and loving whites. If only South Africa was full of them. I had spent my last rand and had no fare to get home. Stan gave me 20 rands. As we said goodbye to each other, Stan and Marjorie asked me if I was planning on coming to Ellis Park the next day. "I'll be coming to Ellis Park for as long as you two are around," I said eagerly. "Look Marjorie and me up," he said, "and we'll talk some more. If you come early enough, we may even hit some. I have a match in the afternoon." I was so happy as I left for the bus stop that on the way I threw a beggar a few coins. I couldn't wait to get home and tell my family about the Smith. Next day I rose early and headed for Ellis Park. True to his word, Stan did hit with me before his match. At about noon, Marjorie and I sat together on the bleachers and watched Stan trounce his opponent. After the match, we had lunch in the players' lounge. We talked more about South Africa. And Stan and Marjorie told me about Agnes and Bremer Hofmeyer, a white Christian